Good morning, Sodom and Gomorrah. Good morning, sinners. No, that wasn't your radio set on the blink again. It is, in fact, this week's edition of Big Mouth, the pop culture talk show for the true connoisseur of music, film, books, telly, and whatever else we fancy. My name is Andrew Harrison, and we are broadcasting from beautiful downtown Soho, where it is nippy to say the least. In a packed programme this week, we will be asking, is La La Land, the blockbuster musical starring Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling, a wondrous return to the golden days of Hollywood, or just a load of singing and dancing and hopping about that makes no sense? Is the new album by hip-hop super duo Run the Jewels going to reignite our love for the rapping and the beats? And what would happen if we merged classics of literature with the very best in low-down pop entertainment? First, let's meet our special guests for today. She is a prolific pop writer and survivor of the glory days of Smash Hits magazine. She has written books from the self-explanatory How to Make It in the Music Business to the children's book series The Awful Tales of Agatha Bilk. She now runs the pop-up art shop Grrr across London, where she sells such wondrous things as throbbing gristle teacups and rock and roll biscuits. It's Sian Pattenden. Hello, Sian. Welcome back to Big Mouth. How are you today?
Thank you. I'm very well, thank you.
Yeah. What's the thinking behind the Grrr shop?
The thinking behind the Grrr shop is we're bringing art to the masses and bringing it the most stupidest, most colourfulest, most accessible, but quite pop music related, weirdly, art that we can, and we get people in to help. We're going to open up in March in North London very soon, so we're preparing for that.
So go looking for Grrr on Facebook. There's about five or six R's on the Grrr, isn't there?
There's four. There's always four. There's not three and there's not five. There's four.
Okay, well, that's me told. Okay, also joining us today is an actual books person for a change. He's the author of The Year of Reading Dangerously, How 50 Great Books and Two Not-So-Great Ones Saved My Life, and also Tilticut Windmills, How I Tried to Stop Worrying and Love Sports. He's also written for The Times, The Telegraph, The Guardian, The Independent, Esquire, Mojo, basically everybody, and he is the co-host of the fantastic Backlisted. It's a kind of a book club by podcast where guests look again at a classic or cult book. It's well worth a listen. It's Andy Miller. Hello, Andy.
Hello,
welcome to our
you?
Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
It is your Big Mouth debut. Thank you for coming. Tell us more about Backlisted then. What's the...
So the idea is that I co-host this podcast with my old friend John Mitchinson. We used to work together for Waterstones about 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. And we felt there was a complete lack in all broadcast media of how books used to get talked about in a Waterstones tea room in about 1995.
Right, okay.
Right, a niche, but yeah. We felt that people talk about books in terribly earnest ways all the time, and we're not against earnestness, but nor are we against applying a bit of humour sometimes as well.
Yeah.
So what we do is we ask people, usually writers, to recommend books that they love, perhaps that have dropped off the backlist, hence the name Backlisted, and then... we spend several weeks reading them and the other books around them, and then we talk about them for a whole hour about one book.
But I don't think that's bizarre at all, because what I find weird is you know, you listen to people talking about books on the radio and a critic will pop up and say there's a great liminal numinousness to this book, and it lasts for a minute and they've done it in a minute. Well, in fact, in real life, an hour to talk about a book is no time at all.
Yeah, exactly.
As the same with an album.
I'm just constantly... Well, the thing is, but in what I write about as well, I feel really passionately that actually the way we all read books and talk about books, and the way you talk about, you know, records and films and culture and whatever on this podcast is actually not the way they're generally represented in the media, certainly not in the books pages. Generally, they're just... And you know, we don't talk about books only in terms of other books, do we? Mm. We talk about, if you read a book, you'll think about, oh, that reminded me of that film.
Yeah.
Or you'll remember where you were when you were listening to a particular record or whatever.
Yeah.
So we try and bring all those things together.
Also with us, as usual, behind the gigantic solid-state mixing desk, he's optimising our key mass band signal quotient and applying best practice full-spectrum mix-down techniques. It's the Jim Steinman of podcasts. It's our producer, Matt Hall. Hello, Matt, how are you?
I own all the rights.
Absolutely, you do. And you are a co-conspirator on the Backlisted podcast,
aren't
you?
Yes, yeah.
I try to get any work done having to listen to all these records and read all these books.
I really don't.
Okay.
That's the problem.
Pray for Matt. Hashtag pray for Matt. Okay, let's get on with it, shall we? We're going to talk about La La Land, the movie. I really did not want to go and see this film. Matt made me go and see it. I do not like musicals or anything without robots or superheroes in it, but Matt insisted. He said, this is what's happening this week, and we owe it to you, the listener, to have an opinion about the biggest movie of January. So off we went. Is La La Land faithful to the great history of the musical, or is it a fabulous reinvention? Can Emma Stone sing, and can Ryan Gosling dance? Or as it says here, can Ryan Gosling act? That's a typo. we'll talk about it in a minute. After something from the soundtrack, this is more or less the entire soundtrack in one piece. From Justin Hurwitz's score, this is as much as we can fit in of the epilogue to La La Land.
Thank you.
Justin Hurwitz's epilogue to La La Land. And if you've seen the film, you'll know why that's more than just an epilogue. Andy Miller, it was almost your special request to come on and talk about La La Land, wasn't it?
Was.
Why is that? What did you make of it?
Well, I put my cards on the table, right? The first book that I wrote was a book about how much I hate sport.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and what it means to be a man when you hate sport. And the accompanying correlative to that is that I absolutely love musicals.
Okay.
Right? And I knew when La La Land was coming out that it would bring out the worst prejudices in people who say, oh, I hate musicals.
Yeah,
like,
that's great.
Like people who love film and love music but can't bear to have the two together, right?
Yeah, but, you know, I love curry reason. And I love profiteroles and I don't want them on the same plate. But anyway,
That's quite nice. Anyway, so I knew preemptively this film was coming out and I knew that there would be a lot of prejudice aimed against it,
yes.
Not least from your producer Matt,
yes.
Who is a sworn enemy of the musical form. And whenever I try and do a regular thing on Backlister where I try and get, if a book has been made into a musical, I always try and shoehorn a tiny excerpt in, and Matt will never let me do it. So I knew when this film was coming out, I knew when La La Land was coming out, that Damien Chazelle, who was the director of Whiplash,
mm-hmm.
had been trying to get this film made for years because of his great love of the French film director Jacques Demy, who made the films The Umbrellas of Cherbourg and The Young Girls of Rochefort, which are two of the greatest films ever made.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen the second one, but Umbrellas of Cherbourg is just incredible. Yeah.
And so I thought, okay, this is not merely a passion project for Damien Chazelle, it's going to be a passion project for me too.
Right.
I have to get in there early to deal with the haters on this,
yes.
Who are going to be numerous simply because it's a musical,
mm-hmm.
right? Did I like it? I absolutely loved it.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't love it because I have a complete non-discerning blanket enthusiasm for all musicals. There are some very bad musicals.
Yes.
But this does a fascinating thing, which in a nutshell is it takes the idea of the musical that Jacques Demy had, which is to have not so much a series of big production numbers, but to have a social realist drama in which the characters sing and dance.
Yeah.
And when Demy made that film in the 60s, it was a huge hit. So was its sequel, The Young Girls of Rochefort. Uh-huh. He's invited to Hollywood. It's his big break.
Uh-huh.
And what he does is he makes a film called Model Shop, which is not a musical, which is set in LA, which features guest appearances by the psychedelic band Spirit,
okay.
but they never play any music.
Okay.
And
so
it was
French.
A huge disaster.
Mm-hmm.
It was known in the industry as Model Flop for many years, and he never got to make another film. And it seems to me that La La Land is Damien Chazelle's attempt to make the film that Jacques Demy didn't make when he got to Hollywood.
Sean Pattenden, as the Queen of Indie Rock and Associated Matters, are you a musicals person? She's glowering,
yeah,
scowling.
You can't see that look on the radio. I quite like musicals. I didn't like this at all.
Really?
Yeah.
What did you dislike about it?
What I disliked about it, yeah, they're quite good at dancing and singing. They don't have to be brilliant. And Ryan Gosling learnt the piano. That's really great. And he plays the piano really well and it's a bit jazzy. That's fantastic. But there is no backdrop of anything. Mm. So it's like comparing Brookside with Neighbours. Where Brookside, it was all we'll make up a team, we'll talk about politics. Neighbours is someone's stolen our cat. It was someone's stolen my cat. I've got a dream. I've got a dream. I want to be an actress. It's like, yeah, and? Yeah, I'm a bit poor. Yeah, and? Mm. Oh, we fall in love. Yeah, and? There's no backdrop to anything. It could be made any time. Mm. I found it really, really static and 2D, and I really, really wanted to like it. I like Emma Stone. I like Ryan Gosling. They're nice people. The nice people that fall in love. But that's it.
See, I went into it not wanting to dislike it, but strongly expecting to dislike it. And for the first 20 minutes, I really did dislike it because it was a full-on jazz hand dancing on car bonnets, brightly coloured dresses routine. And I thought, I'm going to murder Matt Hall for making me go and see this. And then after about 20 minutes, I totally fell for it because having set out the stall of the musical, it then started to pick it to pieces and, you know, deconstruct it. And, you know, what I found really interesting about it was it runs a gamut of tones. Sometimes you feel like you're watching an indie movie mumblecore thing. Everybody's in beige and the tune will pop up that would not seem out of place on Pitchfork's Album of the Week. Then we pop into a kind of like surrealist Charlie Kaufman Synecdoche New York fantasy sequence.
Mm.
Then it's very Busby Berkeley, very down the line. And I just thought that the invention and the charm of it was so powerful that I felt like this wasn't just a musical by numbers. This is somebody who'd thought about what musicals are and decided to look at it from as many different angles as possible. I kind of take your point because in some respects it is the off the peg couple for an LA set drama musical, you know, piece of fiction.
Two white young people fall in love. That's and they have a bit of a dream.
But there's so many, what I did really like it, and I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it from that kind of like smart ass perspective of seeing all the references to
references. You can get a reference, but that's all it was.
It wasn't because kind of, you know, the fact that Emma Stone's character is kind of a struggling actress. It's a bit like Debbie Reynolds in Singing in the Rain. There's the whole backlot bit where they're walking through.
But that's Hollywood on Hollywood. Anyone can do that. They talk about Casablanca. Casablanca has the backdrop of the World War II. So it makes it a film about something else or two people within a situation. And what I felt it lacked was there was no situation. We're in LA. That's fine. Yeah. You've got no money and yet you're buying a coffee.
Isn't that the truth about Los Angeles, though? It's a place where there is no there. There is nothing but fantasy. There is only cinema and musicals and imagination.
It's a film for me. I mean, I totally see what you mean, Sean. But for me, it is a film about people who live in Hollywood. So there's a constant negotiation going on between what their lives are like and how saturated the city in which they live is with film and music. And so those references are not merely like magpie-like little bits of grabbing. They are trying to say something about the psychological backdrop in which those characters live. Now, clearly, it's not an effort in psychological realism, but it is constantly moving backwards and forwards between the extent to which the characters want to express themselves in quotation marks. And sometimes they'll be singing and sometimes they won't be singing. And sometimes they'll be dancing and sometimes they won't be dancing. I think the film gets off to a shaky start, actually. Funnily enough, that big jazz hands opening number, I'm not so sure about
but that. But I kind of quite like the way that everybody's wearing, you know, it's Seven Brides for Seven Brothers colours. You know, there's a woman in a bright yellow outfit, there's a man in a woman in a bright...
I don't think it really starts motoring till Ryan Gosling arrives. And that's partly because I think the film is more about Ryan Gosling than it is about Emma Stone's character.
Well, this has been one of the big debates, hasn't it? Because it's been criticised as this film is about the female obstacle to male achievement. She just gets in his way of his dream of having a jazz club. And I think you can read it exactly in the opposite direction, which is it's the male obstacle to her achieving what her dream is. I mean, he is this kind of needy complainer. Like nobody likes jazz, and even my girlfriend doesn't like jazz. Nobody likes the things I like. Boo hoo! And it's only when she can finally sort of jettison him, and they cease trying to make no spoilers, you know. But I mean, there'll be no surprise to anybody who's ever seen a love story in the movies that the lovers fall out at one point, you know. She actually starts to make any progress towards what she really wants. So I think I liked the fact that you can look at it from two angles, and I also like the fact that it defeats, you know, your kind of basic parsing of sexual politics. Is this a sexist movie? Well, it's a lot more complicated than that.
The plot is thin. The script, I don't know. The script's good, is it?
There was a point where I really wanted them to start singing because I was so bored of the script. Do another song. We haven't had one for 10 minutes. You're really willing them to do that.
I'm sitting there going, don't sing, don't dance.
Certain
characters like Ryan Gosling's horrible sister, I'm like, please don't make her sing. Please don't. And she didn't sing. Thank God for that. She didn't sing.
We should also add that the ending is homage to the point of thievery from the Umbrellas of Cherbourg. That is sort of the ending of the Umbrellas of Cherbourg.
Trying to talk with authority about musicals that I never watch, but aren't musicals and isn't classic Hollywood about the form? You don't want surprise. You want tweaks on. It's almost like a mystery play. You want to see the
variations.
Thing that you expect.
Yes, particularly
in musicals, what you want is the music and the arrangements to shine a different light on this thing where we almost know what's going to happen. We feel ourselves being led through it.
You know, the thing that the French directors and writers of the late 50s and early 60s, like Godard and Truffaut, loved about Hollywood musicals is partly they were the thing that you just said, Andrew, that they were a kind of, they had evolved their own form, which you then created variations on that theme to make something new. But also because they saw musicals at that stage as being the most intense use of different things within the film medium that only film could do.
Yeah.
That you were using the camera and music and dancing and all these other elements to create unreality.
Yeah, and it's a huge metaphor, obviously. Singing and dancing is a huge metaphor. Because, I mean, it's not saucy, is it?
No, there's no rudery.
And what we're talking about is MGM musicals. I mean, really more than anyone else. They were in the 50s. They were, you know, the gold standard. Yeah. That's what people did.
When you kiss, you've got to put your foot on the floor, that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah, the Hays Code. Yeah, it's all Hays Code. Yeah.
Let's talk about the music for a minute. I mean, again, musicals music is usually the kind of thing that'll get me running for the hills. And I can't get the songs from La La Land out of my head. I particularly thought that the score kind of reminded me a bit of Matthew Herbert, and it's kind of like housey. It's quite housey in a weird way. Bum, 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 bum.
Jeremy Deller could do a brass band.
And I found that really strange because it had, it's not just the bright primary colours of, hey, let's have an amazing time. There's a kind of pathos in there that obviously fits perfectly.
The songs
with the
are quite sad, aren't they? The City of Stars. I was singing that as I was cleaning my teeth yesterday, so it does stay with
that
you.
That must have sounded
hard to do while
Again, the score, you know, the score owes a lot to Michel Legrand, who wrote the music for Umbrellas of Cherbourg.
Yeah.
But it also, it has two or three memorable numbers in it, I think. But it doesn't overburden you with big production numbers. I think the idea is, what's important is that the characters are singing, not that they are singing memorable songs all the time. It's that singing as an expression of something that speech can't do.
Yeah. It's actually not so much songs as a succession of figures that are kind of reassembled, and you hear the same little refrains over and over again. It's not like there's eight great songs here.
It's about three, isn't there? I mean, there's not very many, I think, if you were to...
But they're good ones. So basically, running around the table, Sian, you didn't really like it, did you?
I feel a certain warmth to it, but I didn't really like it.
I was really surprised to like it. I came out of it a gibbering wreck. Maybe I'm at that vulnerable age. Andy, obviously you loved it.
I was pleased it existed before I saw it, and having seen it, I'm pleased he didn't muck it up.
Right, Matt Hall.
Loved it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fantastic. We need more things like this.
Yeah. I think you're going to get really into musicals now, Andrew.
That's what I'm frightened of. Okay, let's have some non-jazzy music. Every week we ask our guests to come in with an editor's recommendation, the track that they're obsessed with at the moment. Sian Patnam, what have you got for us?
I've got The Lemon Twigs and A Great Snake.
That sounds great, Sian. Let's have a listen.
Great!
Snake by The Lemon Twigs, as chosen by Sian Patton. And that's very, very Robin Hitchcock there. What do you like them? What's it all about?
Well, I didn't like them. this always happens. I don't like it. And then I listen to it again and go, oh, I quite like it. Now I can't stop listening to it. And there's something quite pompous about what they do, which is the bit I didn't like at first. And now I really like it. They're just sort of... It's sort of like Queen crossed with Beck crossed with some other tiny little skinny people.
Yes.
There's lots of noodling in it. There's lots of chord changes you don't expect. And there's a sort of weird drama and sort of theatre to it, which, as I say, that's the thing I initially thought, no, I really like it. They're not doing anything else. They're from LA, man, probably. And they're American anyway. And they're playing in March, and I'm really excited because apparently live it all comes together.
Ah, right.
And you see it, and it's all that sort of thing. But yes, it's one of those records where I started to put it on, and then I... Put it on every day now. Yeah, embarrassing, isn't it?
Are you saying you really have to see them live, man?
I think we are saying you really have to see them live, man.
Okay, excellent.
I'll be down the front in March.
Marvellous. Okay, in sharp contrast, as I mentioned at the top of the show, there's a new album by the hip-hop duo Run the Jewels, the collaboration between rappers LP, formerly of Company Flow, and Killer Mike, who got his first exposure on Outkast's Stankonia album in 2000, and since built a reputation as a proper tough political rapper. They've been working together for three or four years now, and the new album Run the Jewels 3 gets a physical release this week after a digital release over Christmas. We're going to continue the rich Big Mouth tradition of having a room full of white people talk about hip-hop in a minute. But first, from Run the Jewels 3, here is the first track, Down.
I hope with the highest of hopes that I never have to go back to the trap, and my days are dealing with dope. So I only spit fire and dope, so later on you can go quote.
My lies to your people and folk.
Run the Jewels with Down. Now, we don't usually go to Matt first, but this is your wheelhouse, Matt Hall. What's going on here? Explain who these guys are.
So, well, as you said, Killer Mike comes from Atlanta and is had a marginally kind of successful career, hooking up with various different kind of Southern luminaries, including Outkast and T.I. LP, first, as you said, came out with Company Flow. LP stands for El Producto because he was the production side of things. He's well known for making kind of almost industrial stuff, and certainly some of the Company Flow stuff, which came out in the kind of mid-90s out of that New York kind of backpacker raucous scene, was very, very un-hip-hop in its lack of funk, in its kind of complete noise, and very wordy and very kind of confrontational in terms of, we're really going to make you work at this. But apart from one or two tracks, didn't really float my boat. That wasn't underground enough for him, so he went off and started a label called Def Jux and released a lot of other kind of really underground stuff like Cannibal Ox, which you probably may not have heard of, and then hooked up with Killer Mike about 3 or 4 years ago, put this project together, and since then have become kind of heroes of the alt rap scene, can we say that? And interesting business model. This is their third proper album. They release them all for free, and then you can buy special limited edition ones. They tour massively in the States. They're real kind of like they're kind of road dogs, as it were. They're on the move all the time. They were playing a gig in St. Louis when the verdicts were handed down on the Ferguson shooting, and Mike was on stage 2 hours after the verdict had been handed out and did this amazing off-the-cuff speech about what it meant for his son growing up and what it meant for kind of all black kids growing up. Interesting subtext is that his father was a police officer, so he's kind of spoken a lot about police brutality. And then he went on to support Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primaries. So the interesting thing about this album is that it's actually kind of almost their least political work. I mean, there's a sense of anger there, but there's always been a sense of anger there. I think he said in interviews he's got sick of being the political rapper that everyone goes to and having to explain that Killer Mike doesn't mean he kills people, it means he kills mics.
I must take slight issue with that. I really love this record, right? And you're always seeing articles in newspapers saying, where is the spirit of protest?
Yes, in popular sick to music death now, of that story, right? Yeah.
Look at all the best-selling albums of hip-hop and R&B in America in the last year, couple of years.
Yeah.
Kendrick Lamar, Solange, the Beyoncé album, album.
Yeah.
Happening right now, right in front of people, in huge numbers.
This is a recurring theme on the podcast because people have mentioned this before, the fact that it doesn't count as political music unless it's like four indie kids.
There's a brilliant track on this called Thieves, which starts with a sample from Rod Serling, which is, I think, is from Night Gallery, not the Twilight Zone. Yeah. And then it ends with a Martin Luther King sample, which this week, of course, Martin Luther King, there's been an attempt to appropriate Martin Luther King by the alt-right in the States. Mm. So to hear this voice from 50 years ago being put back into its righteous context, that's really stirring, you know. Yeah. And but also what Matt was saying, like the last track on this album is called The Report to the Shareholders, which in and of itself is great. There's a lyric on that which is, he says, maybe that's why me and Mike get along, not from the same part of town, but we both hear the same sound coming and it sounds like war.
Yeah.
I mean, I love the way this record builds and builds and builds and builds. Mm-hmm. And by the time they get to the last track, they're saying, well, get to the barricades.
Yeah.
It's like Les Miserables.
There you go, Sean, what was your take on Run the Jewels 3? Because this is probably something that you're not entirely on your playlists all the time.
No, because I like my hip-hop Mickey Mouse.
Yes.
I still like De La Soul when they started.
Yes.
You know, I like Jurassic 5. It's like, hello. And I like New York hip-hop because it's all a bit more cerebral. You know, they've got more words in it sometimes.
Yeah.
I don't mind a bit of gangster rap, but when it sounds heavy immediately, the first track doesn't. First track's the hit, isn't it? It's like, well, hey, it was like, well, hey, this is great. And then it goes really heavy and what they sometimes call Scooby-Doo music. So there's going, lots of minor chords in the background.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought, oh, God, we've got the dystopian nightmare and I'm not sure I can do dystopian nightmare. It's Monday morning. Also, they use the B word for ladies quite a lot. Now, initially doing the B word for ladies, I'm not quite sure. Are they nice men or are they? You know, you never can tell whether it's just all about bottoms and things like that.
Yeah.
So had a bit of a think about it.
Yeah.
because I was thought, I'm not sure about the people. Listened to it again, just thought, oh, this is amazing, and just really got into it. And it was almost like this instant first here, I've just got to get used to the whole sound of it. Yes, I thought it was wonderful. The sounds, as you say, you can still hear that sort of industrial feel.
Yeah.
It's quite heavy in that way, but there's all this sort of movement within, all these sort of kind of drug rush bits.
Yeah.
You know, like they know they're going to play in clubs, they know they're going to play it to a really big audience. So you sort of get the highs and the lows of it, really. You know, say
and
you're
no
following
skits.
It.
No
you're
skits,
following
yeah.
A story.
No grout between the tiles, yes.
And they're clever, it's funny, it's witty, all that sort of stuff. So I started to really, really
Mike,
like it.
Mike, they both deliver really amusing punchlines.
Yeah.
You know, each
and
couplet is almost
really,
a kind of gag.
Yeah,
but, you know.
Yeah.
What I really like about it is, like, as Sean's just said, it's really kind of musically constructed. There's a lot going on. And what I mean, as somebody who used to listen to a lot of hip hop and then just fell off as you get older, what I find hard to get into current kind of hardcore stuff is that it can be incredibly sparse. To an outsider, it just feels like there's not that much going on here. It's really, really full. Mm. Also,
yeah,
I like the fact
multi-layered.
That they're not. What I really like about it as well is they're not trying to bully you with their hardcoreness, their macho qualities, their masculinity.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like there's a great confidence.
Which initially
here.
What I had thought because of the use of the B word, which we don't do in this country.
It's
so
interesting.
Much
there
ladies,
is some of
you know
that in
mean?
There, but then again. You know, it's inherent in the form that there has to be some
well,
by the
standard of the form. This is by the standards where every single record is called "I am the greatest human who's ever existed." This is comparatively modest.
I also like the fact that these guys basically make an album a year.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know, they drop an album, they tour it once, they put it out for free, they get another one out there,
and that's
and
amazing,
keep going.
Yeah.
Not content with that, they also put out a remix album last year called "Meow
yes,
the Jewels,"
which is
entirely based around the Meow Mix cat food commercial.
Is it any,
meow,
is it
meow,
any,
meow,
is it,
meow.
I did listen
good?
To it.
I haven't listened to it.
It's not as good as the Run the Jewels record. I'll give it that, but I'll give them this.
Idea.
They put it out.
There's also, and it's not, I think, an official release or even anything that they may have knowledge of. But there's a fantastic remix, about 20-minute mixtape on SoundCloud called Shadow the Jewels, which is basically. Yeah. A cappellas of their first album over beats from DJ Shadows Introducing, which is slightly less frenetic and equally good.
Well, I have to give an on-air apology to friend of the podcast, Paul McGee, who's been banging on about these for years, and I didn't listen to them because of the other people who were banging on about them, because it's getting certain overheated music websites, which only have, they have two settings, this is terrible and should be destroyed, and this is the greatest thing ever. And you just kind of think, oh, come on, it can't possibly be. And so I missed out on the first two albums by this fantastic act. So, Paul McGee, this is your on-air apology. I apologise to you. Let's stay on the hip-hop end of things, slightly hip-hop, because it's sort of Andy Miller's editor's recommendation. And, of course, because Big Mouth is basically the Hot 97 of podcasts. Andy, it's your turn. What tune are you brought in?
Yeah, so I have selected a track called Zombies by Childish Gambino, a.k.a. Donald Glover, the actor Donald Glover.
A.K.A. young Lando Calrissian.
A.K.A.
Coming
Troy
soon.
From Community, the great series Community. And also he's got a series of any of you might have seen this, Matt. He's got a TV series at the moment which is winning all sorts of awards called Atlanta, about two brothers trying to make it in the Atlanta rap scene. It's just won Golden Globe for best series. And
what's it on?
It's on FX.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, they're
just making it over here. Mm-hmm. But so so this is his third record. His first two records were hip hop records. And then out of nowhere, he released this album in December, which is like, with no context at all, is like, I've decided now to be Funkadelic and Sly and the Family Stone. Maybe it's pastiche. Mm. I don't know. But as a thing to have decided, I'm going to find someone to play like Eddie Hazel.
Yeah.
I'm going to find these incredible stacked harmonies in the background as well. And there's a brilliant... The reason I chose this track, Zombies, is the hook doesn't even have a tune. It has this brilliant little bit in the middle where the zombies, who sound like very lovely ladies, are lecturing him from over his shoulder is what it sounds like.
Okay.
It's a terrific record.
Let's have a listen. This is Zombies by Childish Gambino. We'll be right back. That was Zombies by Childish Gambino. Now, Andy, why is Childish Gambino called Childish Gambino?
Well, brilliantly, right? So Childish Gambino is called Childish Gambino because he got his name from the legendary online Wu-Tang name generator.
Oh, really?
He just put Donald Glover into it and out came Childish Gambino. I did it this week. I came out as respected professional.
Well, that's actually what you are. So,
I was so delighted at last.
That's like something that you put on your LinkedIn profile. Okay, moving on. This has nothing whatsoever to do with hip-hop or anything at all. We're going to talk about accidental pop culture mergers. Friend of the podcast, Mark Wood, was on Facebook talking about how he can't stand modern TV. He said, all I watch these days is Hitchcock's Half Hour. You know, I thought, obviously a mistake, but I love the idea of Hitchcock's Half Hour. You know, stone me, what a hideous murder in the Bates Motel. And it got me thinking about merging high culture with pop culture. So in our bid for a full Radio 4 Just a Minute status, we're going to do pop culture mergers and acquisitions. I'm going to start with the TV show about a paranormal antiques dealer and his battles with sideboards that are possessed by the elder gods, H.P. Lovejoy. I can see that you're wandering around in New England, around Miskatonic University. Look at that beautiful armoire. Oh, no, it's full of tentacles. Andy, what have you got?
I'll start with Muriel Sparks in Outer Space.
Very nice.
Scottish lady novelist boldly goes where no one has gone before, seeking what she refers to as the creme de la creme of strange new worlds, new life and new civilizations.
Okay, Sean, let's have on.
Vita Sackville, Kanye West. Hole Digger is one of her hits. That's about being in the garden. Blood on the Leaves, that's about gardening while cutting one's thumb. Diggers in Paris, get it? More gardening. Yeah, and My Beautiful Dark Twisted Basketry with a climbing nasturtium on the pergola. I think she could do quite well.
Marvellous, Matt.
PJ O'Rourke's Drift. Ooh. Contrarian columnist played by Michael Caine finds himself in the middle of the Zulu War.
Yes.
With excellent. Amusing consequences.
Fantastic. Andy, you're good. This is like tennis, isn't it? Go.
The House of Elliots. George Eliot, T.S. Eliot, Missy Elliot, the late Denham Elliot and Billy Elliot set up a ladies' fashion house together, but spend the whole time bickering over the correct spelling of Elliot.
Excellent. I'm going to suggest J.G. Ballard and the Midnighters. Country and Western music about skyscrapers and having sex in crashed cars. Sean.
Brett Easton Ellis Baxter.
Ooh.
Murder on the Dance Floor is the hit.
Oh, yes.
You can totally see
yes,
that.
Yes, yes.
Matt.
John Savage Garden. Ooh, pop historian's ooh, guide to carnivorous plants.
Yes. I think he'd, if he could set that in 1966, it'd be absolutely marvellous. Andy, let's have another one.
The Master and Margarita. It's the most unorthodox detective partnership ever.
Yes.
When Doctor Who's arch nemesis decides to solve crimes with the help of a cheese and tomato pizza.
Live from Delgado's Pizza Joint.
Yeah.
Oh, lovely. Sean, any more on your list?
Well, one-liner really, but Kim Kardashian Banks. With her novel, The Wasp Factory.
Kardashian Banks.
That really does. Math, that's
a got,
for you.
Yeah, J.M. Barry White. Highly suggestive long-form disco workouts. Rather problematically about children who won't grow up.
Absolutely, yeah, with subtext. Yes. Well, I'm going to finish up with Cartland, the Unstoppable Sex Machine. Beloved romance novelist attempts to restore her libido in a journey across Britain with Keith Lemonhead on Channel 4 on Friday nights, obviously. Well, viewers, if you'd like to contribute your own, please come to our Facebook page and give us your mergers and acquisitions in the world of pop culture and entertainment. Is this how they pitch TV shows? This is like youth
yes,
hustling
it
with...
It's monkey tennis.
It is monkey tennis. Really hustling with Chris Eubank.
Yeah.
Well, we are approaching the end of the show and it's time for closing time chatter, where our guests share the stories or ideas that have been exciting them or driving them up the wall this week. Sean Pattenden, what have you got?
Well, I've realised that all social media platforms seem to be following a comedy genre and they each have their own. And it comes from Instagram, where I was looking at Courtney Love's feed. And it's just so accidental Partridge, which, yes, as you know, is accidental Alan Partridge. She's at a wedding at one point with Mark Ronson, who, as we know, is the, you know, the guy, which, yeah, is the Amy Whitehouse and is the you know, he's snappy.
Amy Whitehouse, that'd be another good merger. heavy again. Drinking Camden Songstroll stamps out smut on television. Yes.
So, or Amy Woodhouse, who also.
Amy Woodhouse.
Yeah, tells dogs what to do.
Telling dogs to go buy a bottle of vodka. Anyway, yes, sorry, we distracted you. Yeah. So, accidental Partridge.
Yeah, I think I'm accidental Partridge. But the problem is, you can only really do it if you can do an Alan Partridge impression, I realise, if I have to say it out loud and
give
I can't.
It a go.
What a Natty Dresser. I can't really do it. King of the Uptown Funk. I Am Mark Ronson. Awesome Wedding. You see what I mean? I can't quite do it. But if you read it all in an Alan Partridge voice in your head, she is amazing. I mean, everything is just very awesome. Everything's natty. But everything, you know, I think has a health and safety element.
Do you think she's got a future on North Norfolk Digital? Courtney Love.
Yeah, yeah. I think we should tell her.
Okay.
We'll get. Yeah. But then I realise, anyway, to go on with this theme that no one's interested in, Twitter, Twitter is Fawlty Towers. If you read everything in a Basil Fawlty voice, because it's all about hysteria and it's all about getting the wrong end of the stick and it's all about running up and down those stairs and suddenly, you know, getting it massively wrong. All of Twitter. I mean, I can't even give you an example. You just read it all in the Basil Fawlty voice and it really, really works. Because it's that idea that it's become, Twitter has become more Twitter than Twitter could ever be and anyone could ever imagine. Like Instagram and like Facebook, they all have this niche and people are sort of growing into the niche.
Well, Andy, I think that's a, I believe they call it a segue in the trade. I think this connects with your own closing time chatter, doesn't it? Vis-a-vis.
Well, yeah, I wanted to mention, like, there was a Twitter storm. Yes. There were several Twitter storms this weekend, but one of which was about La La Land, in fact.
Yes.
But the previous day's Twitter storm was the author Jenny Colgan reviewed the new novel by Nadia from Bake Off, which is ghostwritten. And Jenny made a reasonable point, in my view, that the more celebrity ghostwritten novels there are on the shelves, the less space there is for novels by novelists who do nothing except write novels, which I can see. You know, it's an arguable point. Anyway, there was a Twitter storm because people were saying, "Are you saying Muslim women should stay in their lane? Are you saying?" And
it absolutely was not what she was saying.
No, she wasn't saying that.
And in fact, in that very same story, she said, "If you want to read a great story by a Muslim author, a family saga, then here are some options by actual full-time career novelists who are Muslim women." It wasn't about race at all. It was about celebrity, and people were utterly refusing to accept that.
But I think the thing that gave me pause for thought as this thing raged out of control for 24 hours was the speed with which people, with which we, let's say we, although we try not to, but the speed with which we just go into a state of utter fury and apoplexy.
But my Twitter feed is full of
Friday it was this thing with Jenny's review. Saturday it was people going into meltdown about La La Land if they didn't like it. I knew it was going to happen. It's exactly what I was saying at the top. I knew this would happen. And also my timeline is full of people retweeting Trump and expressing impotent, though justifiable, rage about it. And at the same time you think, oh, this is exhausting to read this stuff over and over again. You know, the mental effect of it.
Well, this is pretty much why I've come off Twitter, because what's the point? If I wanted to be shouted at by people who are very, very angry, I can get that for free at home, thank you very much.
You go to Iceland.
I go to Iceland or just travel on any bus, basically.
Yeah.
Matt Hall, what's your closing time chatter?
Well, I've decided to take your stance at the end of this, programme and become kind of Cassandra Harrison. There's a fantastic...
very good.
Yeah. There's a fantastic, miserable blog on the LA Review of Books site by a guy called Jonathan Kirshner called America, America, which is essentially a kind of requiem for the USA, and is very literate and draws in lessons from history from the Greek Republic and lots of different places, but comes out with this fantastic quote: "Worse still, even if we manage to endure the next 4 years and then oust Trump in the next election, from this point forward, we will always be the country that elected Donald Trump as president." Mm-hmm. And as Albert Finney knew all too well in Under the Volcano, some things you just can't apologise for.
Oh. And on that cheery thought, well, mine, slightly less depressing. I read a fantastic piece by Nicholas Barber in The Economist's 1843 magazine, their kind of pop culture and criticism and so forth site. And it was, you know, when you read something that you think, my God, that's so obvious and it's so true. His point was that drama, entertainment, is being destroyed by becoming domesticated. Stories that used to be about, and you know, it's happened to James Bond, it's happened to Sherlock, it's happened to Star Wars, it's happened to Doctor Who, it's happened to the Avengers. Stories that used to be outward looking, the hero would go out into the world attempting to achieve something or trying to escape something. as the franchises continue, they turn inward and the story ceases to be about the great external challenge or threat, and it starts to be about family squabbles. It's about discovering that somebody is somebody's mother or somebody's father, and who is somebody's long-lost brother.
They get weighed down, right, don't they, by their own...
He describes it as universe shrinking, and I think that's really, really true. I kind of gave up on Sherlock a couple of seasons ago, not particularly for this reason. It just really wasn't to my taste. But the complaint about Sherlock was, this is supposed to be Sherlock Holmes solving mysteries. It's not supposed to be about the
absolutely.
Sherlock family saga. I mean, whoever cared about that? Apart from Mr. Mycroft.
There's this episode that's just gone, the most recent episode of Sherlock, ends with a sort of 3 or 4 minute sequence, which is a bit like the end of the House of... at Pooh Corner, with the idea that Christopher Robin and Winnie the Pooh, Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson will be off having adventures forever. Yeah. Right? You sort of thought, I got to the end of it, I thought, no, that's the series I want to watch. Not them standing around being furrowed and hurting, but actually going out and solving some crimes.
Sean, you were about to hop in there.
I was about to hop in, but I was saying it goes in trends. We're talking about Greek narrative. Ah. Greek narrative is the adventurer going off to find something, and there are certain structures that, say, Star Wars uses. And also, I mean, you can say Doctor Who used to use it, and Sherlock would have tried to... It would have had a little bit of that narrative, and it's turned inward, but then something else will come along. We'll have the Greek narrative again. Oh, this is fantastic. It's epic. So it's just a question of phases and those people in TV going, we turn it domestic, and suddenly something will come on and overturn it. So I wouldn't worry. It's this worry that...
I just see it happening.
It's a trend, and then there'll be another trend that turns it outwards again.
I hope so, but I see it happening. I mean, Doctor Who is obviously very dear to my heart, and my entire life it was about... You land on a planet, something crazy is happening. Yeah. The doctor's got to sort it out.
Yeah, which is Greek narrative.
I don't really care about the familial relationships in the world of the companions. I don't care who River Song's mum is, really, ultimately. Nobody cares.
I'm with you, Andrew, on that, in terms of Doctor Who, absolutely. And yet, you've got to acknowledge that when Russell T. Davies brought it back, one of the reasons why it played so well to big audiences was exactly because it placed it in a kind of social realist setting.
But to me, that was interesting and exciting because that was one of the new ways to look at Doctor Who. Yeah. It wasn't the way to look at Doctor Who, and it's become the way to look at Doctor Who.
But also, I think Doctor Who is a children's programme, and so... They're trying to sell it as
family
a...
My programme.
Son likes
family
it.
Programme.
It's a children's programme. Anyway, it still should follow Greek narrative. I agree.
Yeah. No, it's what it should still follow is Final Score. That's the problem.
Barbara also made the point that you could see it in The Force Awakens, the Star Wars Return, when what had been a grand cosmic battle has turned into this. I think it was described as like a familial battle around the royal breakfast table. You know, who's the chosen one, all the rest of it. And I wonder whether that is to do with the kind of narcissism of our age, that people think that their family and their family unit and their little world is all that matters. And it particularly poignant the week that Gene Cernan, last man on the moon to die, the last man to walk on the moon has died, and we are now an Earthbound species.
Yeah, but we're back to impotence. If we feel impotent about world events and unable to control that around, we turn inwards.
Yes.
It may be to do with that, of actually just the fear, the global fear at the moment is pretty high.
It is, yes.
And so it's a reflection maybe on that. But as I say, it will flip. It will flip again.
Well,
we'll all be happy and it will be
thank
okay.
heavens that America is not about to be ruled by a dynastic family of nepotism. Giving each other jobs. So on that bombshell. Right, so that's our show. Thank you to our guest, Andy Miller, who is on a backlisted podcast near you somewhere. Who's coming up?
We're doing the Regency romance novelist Georgette Heyer.
Oh, yes.
We're doing the brilliant children's, or is he children's or not, Alan Garner.
Ah.
And then we're doing an amazing book called The Horse's Mouth by Joyce Carey, which was made into a film starring and adapted by Alec Guinness in the 50s,
yes.
Which, if you've never seen that, is about an artist drinking himself crazy and behaving appallingly for 2 hours, with whom you fall totally in love. Fantastic book.
Okay, fantastic. And thank you to Sean Pattenden for coming in. Tell us what's happening with Gurr then. Where's the next one opening?
Next one is opening in North London near Queen's Crescent in March. Mm. So, yeah.
Will there be special new additions to the Gurr shopping list?
There'll be lots of special new additions, and we'll try and get all those famous people who helped us last time to paint stuff for us. We're trying.
Fantastic. Is there a Facebook?
There is a Facebook. I think it's Guru, but you can find it.
Guru. Okay.
And there's a Twitter. There's an Instagram. There's all this stuff, if you can be bothered. Yeah.
Fair dues. Okay. Well, remember, listeners, beloved listeners, you can hear this show again, and in fact, all of our archive at audioboom.com/channel/bigmouth. And you can subscribe via iTunes if you wish. You can go to the podcast section, search for Big Mouth, subscribe, and you will get the podcast version of the show on Saturday, not Sunday. So you've got a little bit of extra time to listen to it. Matt and I will be back on SohoRadioLondon.com at 9 a.m. next Sunday playing the full versions of all the songs, not just the short versions. And in the meantime, we're going to finish with my editor's recommendation. Let Joy Be Unconfined, British Sea Power are back. The sixth album by the Wilfred Owen Joy Division of the Lake District will be called Let the Dancers Inherit the Party. It is a riotous pro-European album for all Romaniac street preachers. And this is the first track. This is called Bad Bohemian. Stand firm, Britain. We will see you next week.